is the connection. Paradigm is defined by the dictionary as an example that serves as a pattern or model. The short, sad life of Shirley Wilder is a paradigm of what happens to children born into the hardest hardcore poverty. By the time the 12-year-old Wilder turned up in Manhattan's family court just before Christmas 1972, the world had essentially abandoned her. As a homeless child in New York City, her hope of being taken in and sent to a foster home, which could provide her a place to live like a child, was pretty much extinguished. She was not Catholic or Jewish, and agencies representing these two faiths ran most of the city's foster care homes. Shirley Wilder's life provides another kind of paradigm. This one is legal. The case based on it is a paradigm of how a dedicated, tenacious lawyer can change the system, even if it takes more than two decades to see the case through. Now, by studying paradigms, we learn about the structures of our society. Connection listeners, we're talking in this hour about the life of Shirley Wilder and her children and the lawsuit filed in her name. What is the state's responsibility to its abandoned children? Should faith-based welfare groups simply take care of their own? And is it possible to construct a foster care system that works today and will still work in the future? Call 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and join the Lost Children Connection. You can also join the discussion online at our website, www.theconnection.org. Emails, postings, and we'll try and get some of your comments, read some of your comments on the air later in the program. I'm joined by a line from our studio in New York by Nina Bernstein, author of The Lost Children of Wilder. Nina Bernstein is a journalist. She writes for the New York Times and has written a study of this case. Nina, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to be speaking with you. It's a wonderful book. Let me just ask you to begin at the beginning and tell us, who was Shirley Wilder?
Shirley Wilder was a motherless, abused child who was turned over to the foster care system by, well, actually, she had been, she lost her mother when she was four. At nine, she was raped. By the time she was 11, her grandmother had died, and she was turned over to an alcoholic father and a stepmother who beat her. And everybody agreed that Shirley needed foster care placement. The problem was that the system that she confronted was run by religious charities, faith-based charities, we would call them today, and most of them, though they received almost all their funding from public taxes, were controlled by Catholic and Jewish groups. Historically, they had been the most important.
Okay. Let me. We'll come back to the question of the system briefly, but there's more to her story than this. I mean, what happened at the... Your book actually begins with her kind of forced entry into the netherworld of homes and so on.
Let me tell you that with Shirley Wilder, you have to imagine Shirley spending her 12th year in detention, in a detention center of the family court in New York City. Time after time, she comes to court, and agency after agency turns her down. Finally, a judge who is on the verge of retirement and who has dedicated her life to changing the system, in desperation, by default, sends her to a harsh state reformatory, the New York State Training School for Girls at Hudson. And there, Shirley, who has just turned 13, is basically raped with a broomstick by older girls. And when she fights back, she's punished by solitary confinement. She tries to run away. I mean, by no surprise. One of the scenes that, to me, is most telling about the book and about the deep history of the arrangements that Shirley and later her own son encountered in the system comes when she tries to escape the grounds at Hudson, and she stumbles on a lost cemetery in the woods. She's at the edge of a ravine, and there are these gravestones scattered on this site with no epitaphs and no dates on the gravestones, just girls' names. Those girls were, in fact, former inmates of what had been at one time, actually in the 19th century, the Women's House of Refuge. And Shirley, terrified, runs in the opposite direction and eventually, of course, is caught and again.
But
by the time...
It's an extraordinary picture you paint. And
yes.
She'd done nothing wrong. I mean, she'd committed no crime. She was just homeless on the street.
No. Well, she had committed no crime. She was basically an abused child. And,
but it sounds like she was saying...
And her fate was very similar to... There were thousands of African-American Protestant children like Shirley who ended up either left in abusive situations. There was something called a paper bag test, actually, at the time that workers would not take into custody or were reluctant to take into custody children whose skin was lighter than a grocery bag. Darker than a grocery bag. Because they knew the agencies, the private foster care agencies, the largely religious, would be unlikely to take them. So the others were criminalized. They essentially the only place to send them was these reformatories like Hudson. By the time Shirley did win acceptance after a lawyer, Marsha Robinson Lowry, made her a named plaintiff in this lawsuit that challenged the whole system. After Shirley was finally accepted by one foster care agency, she was 14 and she was already a mother. And the agency, a Catholic agency, denied her what everybody agreed she needed, birth control. She pleaded for contraceptives. But they were against the principles, the religious principles of the agency. And there's actually a scene in my book where her social worker, who was a nun, in desperation, tried to teach this impulsive 14-year-old in a coeducational institution, the rhythm method of birth control.
Hmm. One last question. I mean,
yeah.
If she had been given any chance, I mean, what were her skills and talents? And then we'll move on.
Shirley was this resilient, appealing girl who, interestingly enough, again and again, lawyers and judges who encountered her felt drawn to her, wanted to do better by her because she had this quality that made, one lawyer said she was like one of the children in a Benetton ad. I don't know whether people still, the colors of Benetton, whether people still remember those. But just a kind of shine to her and a strong sense of right and wrong. There was really a sense that she could have had another life.
And into the life that she was given entered Marsha Lowry, who's a remarkable figure in her own right, who was a lawyer and decided that what had happened to Shirley was wrong and that the system needed to change.
Absolutely. I mean, she found Shirley. Actually, Shirley was the named plaintiff she was looking for. She felt the injustice of this system and she wanted to challenge the whole scheme. She felt it was unconstitutional, that it violated the separation of church and state and equal protection before the law. The way that I was drawn into writing this book, which became for me an 8-year project, was the mystery of one lost baby. I went to Marsha Robinson Lowry in the 1990s, in the early 1990s, when I was researching the terrible problems in the foster care system in New York then, and went through the stack of documents in this lawsuit that Marsha had filed, the known as Wilder. It was still controversial. It was still in court.
It had been around for 20 years at that point.
It had been around for 20 years. And there were lawyers who likened it to the case in Bleak House that had dragged on so long people forgot what it meant. And I found buried in these documents this fact that I couldn't forget, which was that Shirley, who was 13 when the case was filed in 1973, had given birth to a son the following year, and she had to leave him behind in the same foster care system that the lawsuit had been battling to change ever since. And it was one of those moments, Michael, when as a reporter, you know, the buzzer goes off in your head, and I knew that I wanted to find out what had happened to that baby. I just believed that if I could unravel that, I would have not only a window on the foster care system, but on this long history of American crusades to try to fix it.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the paradigm case of Shirley Wilder, her son Lamont, and Lamont's child as well. We'll get to talk about all of them and their fate in the foster care system in New York. We're talking with Nina Bernstein, author of The Lost Children of Wilder. The questions remain, can faith-based institutions played a significant part in the foster care system in New York City. Can they actually provide, meet all the social needs of a big metropolis like New York City? Is it right to put that kind of pressure on them? What can society do to make way for the tens of thousands of kids who will be abandoned over the course of the next few years to the fate, the tender mercies of the state? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, makes the Lost Children connection with Nina Bernstein. Nina, the case itself, the lawsuit, there's no constitutional guarantee for child welfare. So what did Marcia Lowry have to do to try and find the angle to make a convincing case to get to force change into the system?
Well, she had, in fact, a very strong legal argument that at the time that this state law that allowed religious charities to use public money but give preference to children of their own kind, children of their own religion, was unconstitutional under the First Amendment. And she also had worked very hard to gather the statistical evidence and the deposition testimony that showed it discriminated against children who were non-Catholic, non-Jewish, and non-white. In fact, to give you an idea of what the system was like, one of the stories that came out in a deposition was that the nuns, the well-meaning nuns of the New York Foundling, when they were in doubt about a baby's racial heritage, would carry the infant to the Museum of Natural History in New York to be examined by an anthropologist. And if that baby had African-American heritage, according to the anthropologist, the chances were that the baby would spend the rest of his or her infancy in an institutional nursery and never be placed for adoption. The thing is that this system was so hard to change that even when it was taken over by a black director. Sorry.
I tell you, the music means we're coming up to the break. We'll pick up the story just after the break. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, the Galapagos Islands, evolution versus creationism.
Lost Children Connection. We're talking in this hour about the new book, The Lost Children of Wilder, with the author Nina Bernstein. We're talking about the responsibilities of the state to care for children who are abandoned. Connection listeners, does the state have a responsibility? Is this a place for faith-based organizations? In New York City, where Shirley Wilder was born, faith-based organizations had been in place providing the kind of aid that the state was unable to provide from the late 19th century. That's how long the system had been in place. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. The big inhale was Nina Bernstein, who's actually in New York. She's not in the studio with me. We can't see each other, which leads to that sort of thing. Nina, in the case of Shirley Wilder, is this a question of malfeasance? I mean, before the break, you were talking about nuns taking African-American children down to...
children when they weren't sure of their racial heritage.
Of course, then they would pass the brown paper bag test, wouldn't they? If you're not sure, then maybe they'll pass. Was there malfeasance at work here in the charities?
No, look, one of the things about this, the research that I did for this book, I really found very few villains. There were many very well-intentioned people. And I think the story of what happened to Shirley's son, Lamont, really demonstrates this. Lamont Wilder entered the foster care system as a newborn. He was essentially born into this case that challenged the system. And for the first 5 years of his life, he beat the odds of the system. He was with the same loving Hispanic foster mother, Alicia Fils-Aimé, in the Bronx. But here's where the unintended consequences of good intentions come into play. Reformers were pushing for more adoptions in the late 1970s, as they are today. And Shirley's parental rights were being terminated. And Alicia was given an ultimatum: adopt Lamont now or give him up. And she was, at that particular point, going through a divorce. She was about to lose her low-wage job. And she was afraid that she and her own son would end up on welfare. So she bowed to the conviction of caseworkers that Lamont would be better off. I mean, Lamont, this happy, outgoing, bright black child, in all the reports at the time, she bowed to the conviction that he would be better off with a stable, financially well-off two-parent family. And from one day to the next, he was sent to be adopted by a white couple in Minnesota, Nan and Bill Miller. What she couldn't know is that within a year, the Millers would change their minds. And it was fascinating to me when I caught up with Nan Miller. She described, and Bill as well, that did not deny, that he had told her, it's him or me. And she calculated, not unlike Alicia, that divorce would leave her struggling to support two children. She told me the decision to give up Lamont was like choosing to have one of your children die. But I wonder whether an Alicia or a Nan Miller today would really be empowered to choose differently, because welfare is more stigmatized and more uncertain than ever.
The story with its coincidences and its terror, I mean, the term is, of course, Dickensian. The difference is that in a Dickens novel, Davy Copperfield ultimately ends up, everything is okay. And after all of the pain that Oliver Twist goes through, everything ends up okay. But with The Lost Children of Wilder, nothing ends up okay.
Well, I have to say that makes it sound very bleak indeed. I one of the things that I see in Lamont, and saw in Lamont, and others did as well, was a charismatic child, the resilience of the a sense of justice, a sense of a yearning for family comes through. And it's true, Lamont became a legal orphan, and when he was not yet seven, he was shipped back to New York, labeled unadoptable, and went to a place, the Astor Home for Children, that is really a kind of a paradigm for the modern-day orphanage that some are even now advocating as an alternative to foster homes, multiple foster homes, ghetto neighborhoods, and so forth. There are those who see this as an answer, which, through the lens of my book, I have to say I see another example of historical amnesia, how that causes us to reinvent the failed solutions of the past. But it was, in some ways, the best a kind of institutional offering the system had, and the kind of institutional offering that Marsha Lowry's lawsuit had been struggling to open to African-American children like Lamont. The problem was that the reality that he experienced there in this mansion built by an Astor, the heir to a fortune, was, you know, a place where the senior psychologist was convicted of molesting, sexually molesting the small boys.
You promised me that it was going to get better. It hasn't. It hasn't, Nina. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tom is on the line.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to try to relate what you folks are talking about to contemporary issues right now that are happening, and that's not to say you haven't done that so far, but I'm a parent of two adoptive children. They are wonderful, healthy, happy, Caucasian children. They're very young still right now. We've been involved in this process for about 8 years. And
how old were they when they came to you, Tom?
They were 3 and 5. They came separately. Mm-hmm. And these are my two main points, and I really want to thank you and for taking my call so I can raise these issues, because I've been looking for a forum for the longest time to discuss this.
Okay.
The major problem that will never be solved, which is the warehousing of these children, cannot be solved unless there is a major, major effort to recruit qualified adoptive families. There has been some improvement, but there needs to be such a major push. The second issue, and I'll take both these answers off the line, is that there is continuing a tremendous amount of stigma and discrimination against these children, which is being resolved currently by most middle-class and upper-class families who want to adopt by going abroad.
Subject of yesterday's connection, it should be said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed
that's
that.
Good. That's good. But you would say that is not the way to go. I mean, you would say to prospective adoptive parents, don't worry about going overseas. There are plenty of kids here in the U.S.
When we went to adopt, we never considered adopting domestically. We were never presented with the option of adopting foster children. Nobody ever assumed for a moment we would want to adopt anything other than an infant. It wasn't until we happenstance met a couple who had adopted 3 children domestically from the foster care system, and we could see what beautiful, happy, healthy children they were, that we were faced with this option. The option to adopt domestically and to adopt from the foster care system is taken such a far back seat, because most of the private agencies who are running the bulk of the adoption services in this country don't make a nickel off of domestic adoptions. They force you.
Nina, why don't you come in and respond to that?
Yes, no, I have to say you have a very good point, and it's very sad to hear this, because this was the reality also in New York when parents tried to change the system. But I have to say that I think we are not going to be able to adopt our way out of the foster care problem or the foster care crisis. And the stigma that you speak of is really related to a larger problem. And that problem, I think, is that we haven't confronted the contradiction between saying that we want to help all needy poor children and saying that we want to deter or punish the unworthy poor parent. What I'm thinking of is that children who are taken from poor parents are not given a level of care that is better than what the poorest working parents can buy for their kids. I mean, I think there's almost an iron law that operates in American social welfare to that effect. Quality substitute care either has to be scarce enough or it isn't quality care. And I think it's not an accident that we see this repeated again and again.
Tom, do you have a quick response to that?
Yeah, just one quick response. I'm not sure if I agree that we cannot solve the problem through adoption. I think you're certainly correct in that many of the children who go into the foster care system will never be placed for adoption. I guess what I'm referring to are the many, many children who are put in the foster care system who are available for adoption but simply are not placed because our culture does not place any value on adopting children from the foster care system.
Tom, so, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I appreciate your comments. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Buffalo. Steven.
For taking my call.
Sure.
For the past 8 years, I've been involved in administrating foster care and adoption programs, predominantly for African-American, what's called social settlement organizations. Returning to the question of religion, for right now, religion has become a protected class, so that for a foster care child would need the permission of a parent to be placed in a home other than the natural religion. So that if there's a Protestant child, you would need to have parental consent to place that child in a Catholic family. That family also, however, would have to respect the parents' wishes and bring that child, for instance, to Protestant services on Sundays.
Nina, was this the case with Shirley? I mean, did she identify in any particular with any particular church?
Shirley was a Baptist, but basically, what we're talking about here is sorting children not by their needs, not by the best home for them, but by a baptismal certificate. Or there were really some terrible instances in New York of children who were removed from loving parents because. Loving foster parents would be adoptive parents because of some birth certificate that was found that essentially gave ownership to a religious group. I want to say something else, though, I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask Steve.
Yeah.
The other question, which really transcends mm-hmm. religion, is very clear, is the issue of race.
Let's get it out there.
It's quite obvious when we talk about Catholic and Jewish faith-based organizations, we're talking predominantly about white people.
Well, and in the case of in New York City, you'd be talking in over the last 30 years, Steve, I think you'd be talking about Hispanics.
I'll have to say that since that time, and in response to perceived neglect and abuse, really. There had been a whole range of African American, say ethnic minority racial organizations who have grown up in a sense to respond to the needs both of their communities and their children. I have to finish here. One of the more dangerous evolutions in modern times has been the enactment of the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which makes race irrelevant in the placement of children.
So you think you would say race is relevant then?
Oh, absolutely, it's relevant. We all take meaning from our community, our culture, our language, our food, our music, our dress, our relatives. These are the things that anchor us in place.
Nina,
and time.
I think we're always here. What we're always talking about is the children of the poor. In some places, the children of the poor are more likely African-American, or they're Hispanic, or they're American Indian. In some eras, they've been Catholic and Jewish and white. And what happens, too, is that these children, who are the least politically powerful of any members of our society, become, to some extent, I think, pawns in what is, after all, a big business. And they also become pawns in a kind of ethnic, political rivalry, patronage, politics. The politics of New York City really is inscribed in this case, and it includes the rise of what were at one time poor Jews from Eastern Europe, poor Catholics from Ireland.
Yeah, that's the point to make, that much of mm-hmm. the system that Shirley Wilder found herself put into, you know, would have been seen as the best kind of self-help organizations from 1910, still carrying on in 1972. They become institutionalized institutions, yeah?
Right, that's right. And they have an interest. Realistically, there is a conflict of interest built in between foster care agencies, whether African-American run or Catholic or Jewish, who have to keep their beds filled, who are paid under contracts that pay them usually for every day a child is in care. And the interest of the children, which is ultimately to have a family that they can call their own, that isn't necessarily adoption. That may be their own family. I think that for me, this 8-year project came to an end at a point when I saw Lamont Wilder, who had aged out of the system he entered as a newborn, trying desperately to be a real father to his little boy and being thwarted by the unintended consequences of another kind of crusade.
I want to thank Steve for his call. And Nina, the question is out there now. I mean, in your view, race or class has most to do, or should be the biggest consideration, in caring for the kids, in getting them into the right circumstances so they can get back on track?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that class is very important. We've seen race, and in our time, race essentially has taken the place of religion in most places in America as a marker for class. But really, what we want for children is a family, is a human attachment. And, you know, Lamont's care cost taxpayers $500,000. You cannot do better if it's possible than a child's own family. And if we did better by poor families, perhaps there would be fewer children coming into the system in the first place.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, 500 miles off the coast of Ecuador, the Galapagos pits environmentalists against...
about her book, The Lost Children of Wilder. The Wilder case has become a well-known case, filed on behalf of Shirley Wilder and other complainants, alleging discrimination in the New York City foster care system, and it took how many decades to work its way through the system, Nina?
Well, it took 26 years. It had been settled after 15 with promises of sweeping change.
Sweeping reform in the foster care system in New York City.
That's right. And a system was supposed to be put in place that would ensure this placement was fair for all children in New York. But it was very hard to enforce. It went back to court. There were contempt motions. And the powers that be really dragged their feet. And then the city began to say that it was obsolete until in 1995, Marsha Robinson Lowry was essentially faced with, do I walk away from this or do I think about bringing an even bigger, more comprehensive lawsuit against...
And at the heart of the suit, it was a First Amendment argument, right? The heart of the case was that basic constitutional rights were being abridged because the system was mostly reliant on faith-based organizations to provide services, and if you fell outside that purview, then you might not get access to those services.
I would say the heart of the suit was that in practice, it discriminated against non-Catholic, non-Jewish, non-white children, and ultimately the city's top lawyer, Fritz Schwartz, essentially agreed and worked very hard to get the city to settle the case with these promises of sweeping change, of a placement system that would really look at the needs of a child and place them in the best, give every child the same shot at the best possible placement. The problem is,
of course,
that the system had gotten worse by then.
Okay. There's an evolutionary question when a lawsuit takes that long to get through things. We're joined now on line by Nick Scapetta, who is the current commissioner for New York City Administration of Children's Services. Hello, Nick.
Good morning.
What's your view on using the courts to advance this kind of change?
Well, the lawsuits like this focus attention on problems and get reluctant municipalities to address these issues and begin reform. After a period of time, the history of these kinds of lawsuits is that they then become counterproductive after some initial success. 26 years of a lawsuit to reach a result, it's just not an effective way to do it, not an efficient way to do it. In fact, discrimination in child placement ended decades ago, but then the lawsuit grew, and there were many other issues that were injected into the lawsuit. The use of MSWs, when...
what is an MSW, Nick?
Master of Social Work. When should the case, the placement be assessed? In my own experience, I find it counterproductive after a period of time. This has been the history in Washington, D.C. It's been the history in other jurisdictions as well. But lawsuits do force government to focus on the problem.
How has New York City focused on the problem in the time we've been working at Children's Services?
Well, now in the last 5 years, there's been enormous change and reform in the New York City child welfare system, and that all began in 1996 when a new agency was created, but not just a new name, but an actual agency, independent, reporting directly to the mayor. The mayor put over $520 million into child welfare, not because...
But, Nick, part of the reason he did that...
Go ahead.
Excuse me, but I was just going to say, Nick, part of the reason that the mayor did that, in fact, part of the reason that he appointed you was that not only that had there been the Elisa Izquierdo abuse death, which was covered by the news media very extensively, but at that point, Marsha Lowry filed a lawsuit that galvanized the sense that this system really needed to change.
If we had more time, I could give you chapter and verse, but the lawsuit was counterproductive to reform. It truly was.
Okay.
Because there is an independent national group of experts that came out of the settlement of the lawsuit who gave a final report, gave several reports, and in their final report, they said for 3 years before the settlement, New York City had made extraordinary progress in reforming child welfare, and they listed initiative after initiative. They also point out that during their advisory period, we made even more success. This is not my judgment on the lawsuit. This is the judgment of national experts. So that the lawsuit, and I could give you many specific examples where we were kept from moving ahead on reform initiatives for 8-10 months at a time because of the lawsuit and wrangling by the plaintiffs.
But let me ask you both, is this an example of what's meant by the phrase in the system? You know, once somebody gets in the system, when we talk about the justice system, we mean disappearing to the tombs in Rikers, and you may not see that person in the same condition. It's going to take a long time. Now the bureaucrats are at it. Similarly, what happens with a lawsuit? I mean, it gets in the system, doesn't it?
Well, certainly this is an aspect of that. Michael, for me, I just want to say that the reform of the state of child welfare reform in New York City isn't an abstract issue. For me, the measure is really what happens to Shirley Wilder's grandson? What happens to Lamont's child? And part of the difficulty that the Administration of Children's Services faces in New York is that it cannot handle this alone. You have had at the same time a policy of welfare reform that resulted in Shirley Wilder's grandson being turned away from emergency food stamps and Medicaid in the name of welfare reform when he was 3 years old. It resulted in Lamont Wilder, who was struggling to be a father to this little boy, having to give up his effort to win custody because, in part, he's facing thousands of dollars of child support debt, part of the welfare reform crackdown on deadbeat dads.
If you want to get a picture of what's going on in child welfare, it's not all that helpful to look at one particular case. There were 43,000 children in foster care in 1996-97. There are now 31,000 children in foster care. We remove almost 2,000 children each year less than the year before. Caseloads for child protective caseload workers are down from around 30 to down to around 12 or 13. Caseworkers are paid better. They have stricter qualifications that they must meet in order to become caseworkers. You need graduate school now to become a supervisor. Training went from 4 weeks to 10 months. You have to look at system reform because there are 53,000 complaints that we investigate every year. By law, we must investigate every single one of them. If you were 99% effective, there would still be 530 cases that you didn't do well, right? So that you can look at any particular case, and the book is a wonderful, moving picture of what happens to some families, but not because of the child welfare system. Shirley Wilder, just look at the book for a minute.
Okay,
and see what happens.
But a hot minute, Nick, a New York minute, because we have lots of calls. We're coming to the end of the hour.
Okay, 1 minute more. Shirley Wilder was a kid who at 4 or 5 saw her mother commit acts of prostitution. At 5 or 6, she saw her father beating her mother viciously. By the time she was 9, she had been raped herself. By the time she was 12 or 13, she had engaged in many acts of sexual intercourse, apparently for pay, in the presence of her younger sister when she was sitting.
We've heard the details, Nick. We've been through this.
But here's the thing. That's before she came to child welfare, before she was in foster care. The most effective system in the world would be enormously challenged.
But
child welfare is also what is happening to Shirley and her family. I think the definition of child welfare is too narrow if it doesn't include intervening in families where children are being treated like that.
Nick, thanks very much.
Sure.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Hillary is on the line.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Michael, thank you for hosting yesterday's show and today's, because they were both very interesting.
Thank you.
My husband and I last year qualified as foster/adoptive parents in Massachusetts and wound up not taking a child into our home. And that was partly because we just felt that there was a combination, even though the social workers we were working with were probably decent, well-meaning people, we just felt we weren't properly supported. And at the same time, we just heard so many horror stories. We're actually now looking at an international adoption for that reason. And, you know, as you put it earlier, Michael, the situation here is almost beyond Dickensian. I mean, it's hard to imagine how it could be any worse. So I'm wondering,
what do you see as a solution to this situation?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask. What are some of the solutions people are looking at? I mean, one thing that occurs to me is privatization, which I know probably is just like anathema to many people in the.
Is it anathema to you, Nina Bernstein?
Well, I when you say privatization, I'm not sure what you mean. Speaking of for profit, because clearly the system in New York City was precisely a largely privatized system. I mean, they were ostensibly nonprofits. But what do you mean when you say privatization?
Well, I actually mean not necessarily for profit, but I mean with some sort of accountability and, you know, an accountability that's enforced.
That's the rub, isn't it? I mean, in fact, I think the one of the things that the Wilder case demonstrates is that it is very hard in the politics of cities, in the politics of poverty, to hold these agencies accountable. Ed Koch, for example, repudiated the settlement his own lawyer had reached because he wanted to essentially placate Cardinal O'Connor in the Catholic vote.
But I think that what Hillary might be suggesting when she says privatization is, let's get this problem away from politicians so that they aren't playing politics and saying, John Cardinal O'Connor, I need your support on other things, therefore I'm not going to hit you hard on this.
Well, but it's when you have public money, which is what we're talking about here, and contracts. I mean, the idea of privatization is you have a contract with a private entity, and you then hold them accountable for performing the way you want.
Yeah.
The reality is that that accountability, and we've seen it again and again, is it shifts. If you are as the foster care system was, the city was in the 1990s, begging agencies to make room for a flood of kids coming in because of crack, you are not in a position to say, you know what, you're not doing a good job, and so we're going to close you down, or we're not going to give you kids.
I want to thank Hillary for her call and getting us talking about that. We are now coming to the end, and the one thing that we haven't done is we haven't told listeners, Nina, what actually happened to Shirley Wilder?
In January 1999, just a few days before the Wilder lawsuit was finally put to rest, Shirley Wilder died at 39 alone in a hospice of AIDS. I think, the last person to visit her, and I showed her a photograph of her grandson, the grandson she'd never seen. And I know that for Shirley, the most important thing was for him to be free of the system, for him not to go into foster care. And I'm still hoping that somehow Lamont will be able to make this child a home.
Nina, thank you so much. Nina Bernstein, author of The Lost Children of Wilder. I can recommend this book very, very highly. It's more than just social history. It's extremely well written, and it has the kind of twists and turns we associate with Charles Dickens. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.
This is WB.